I remember when the first ministerial conference, in a sense, which happened in Marrakesh on April the 15th of 1994, when there were a few NGOs who did venture to participate there, and questions were, asked that, how do you fit in an NGO into this kind of framework where this is basically a meeting of governments aided by business associations mainly. When we speak about non-state actors, of course, business federations, business associations are also included. But traditionally it has been the governments have been consulting mainly with business associations without the kind of access to non-business public interest associations, which are today much more existent or much more present on the scene than they were ever before. Over time, the way it has the whole trading system has developed, and in many ways, in many countries, including through various processes, they have been able to influence public policy, trade policy in particular, such. So their role as well as their existence is now much more part of the architecture than it was ever before. And it is here to stay. I still remember at one point of time when the WTO was founded that the amount of NGOs who wanted a seat on the table or wanted to get inside, the kind of remarks which were made was that you require a football stadium in order to adjust the, in order to keep the, kind of, be, provide a seat for all the possible NGOs. One of the major issues at that point of time which was being discussed was in terms of the interest of NGOs was the issue of sustainable development, which was in a way limited in the interpretation to mean environment, though we from the South, many of us NGOs from the South, believe sustainable development is a much more wider concept than just talking about environment. It also talks about poverty alleviation, etc. But that was the background. I still remember participating in a very major meeting organized by the GATT in June of 1994 on trade and environment, and there were nearly about 500 delegates to that particular conference. That was the kind of interest. And many of the issues which were discussed were quite foreign, were quite sort of unknown to many of us from the South. But since then, things have moved much more fast. The fact is that trade policy or the way the trade architecture has now moved much beyond border measures, border tariff measures and stuff like this. They, as has been often said, that sovereignty itself has been multilateralized. A lot of decisions which are taken here would impact a national policy and not really the legislature of that particular country or the parliament of the country would have little say because of the kind of obligations which the country has accepted at the WTO. Considering that itself, it then also became a kind of raison d'etre of sense that in a globalizing world, how do you ensure that the kind of role which non-state actors play, whether at the national level or the international level, in partnership or in conjunction with networks as well as organizations like ICTSD, etc., to be able to inform, to be able to conduct a more informed debate nationally itself. One of the recent projects which CUTS has done in Eastern and Southern Africa called Fostering Equity and Accountability in the Trading System. We looked at as to how trade policy making processes are going on, kind of an empirical work in order to establish the parameters which happen and in order to show as to how the government is open to making trade policy in terms of its consultative processes and how does it involve a very large number of stakeholders rather than limited either to a part of the government, which means a bureaucracy, or just some business association. And we found that things are changing, they have changed, and the inclusiveness is much higher than before. You come out with an index, what is called the Trade Policy Making Index, and we hope that a study like this would be able to influence the debates in future as well and improve the inclusiveness of how policy is made, because it does have an impact and affects a very large number of people rather than just importers and exporters. What we do also hope to do is that if these concerns which are articulated at the national level is to bring it to the at Geneva, including at various other international capitals, so that there is a better informed discussion even at the international level, which is not divorced from the kind of national realities which take place, in spite of the fact that it could be very complex, it could be very wide-ranging. I mean, what happens in Malawi or kind of reaction in Malawi may be quite different than what happens in Bangladesh or Laos, for example. Yet there could be certain commonalities, or at least in terms of processes, which are important as to how the kind of discussions which happen here are informed with those kind of views which emanate from a fisherman or from a poultry farmer in some part of the world or the other. In today's discussion, we will attempt to sort of answer four questions. Does the business community think that the WTO serves its interests? There again, there will be a lot of variations. The second question that I would like to the panelists to address is, how influential are civil society organizations in the decision-making processes of the WTO? Number three, how crucial is the role of parliamentarians in the WTO process? And finally, how do governments, and this is of course the most trickiest part, how do governments reconcile the interests of various stakeholders, various non-state actors with varying interests and varying thoughts about a particular process? Now, to address these questions, including any other question that the panelists may think is important, they are welcome to add to it. We have a very, very enlightened panel here, representing stakeholders of the variety that I spoke about. Pascal Kernis is the Managing Director of the European Services Forum. He has studied law, has worked with the European Commission in the past, has worked with the Banking Federation, has been closely involved with WTO negotiations since a long time. Pascal was appointed as the Managing Director of the European Services Forum in January 1999, which is the European Services Forum is a network of which membership comprising of 40 major European service companies and 40 European service federations representing about 20 different services sector. So to begin with you, Pascal, could you share with us your views on these questions that I have addressed? It could even go beyond the issue of business stakeholders as well as to, I mean, you've been on the scene for a long time and we've interacted quite often, so I'm sure you understand a very wide range of issues. And about 7 to 10 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Pradeep. Thank you very much for the invitation to this panel. Just to start with quickly, what is ESF? I mean, Pradeep just introduced it quickly to you, but this is covering all the different services sectors that you have there on the slide. And because when we talk about services, most of the time people talk about it is something else than agriculture and something else than NAMA. This is what people are understanding about services when we talk about in this environment of WTO. But it's actually covering a very large part of the economic activity in Western and also developing countries. Here are some of the different companies which are members of the organization. That is for a very short introduction. Now, a provocative reflection maybe for a start of this discussion in this panel. The GATT and the WTO afterwards has been created to facilitate trade, and then i.e. reducing the tariff at the beginning and then reduce the discriminatory treatment between domestic and non-domestic actors. If we then take the consideration that the trade actors are in the world economy are the companies, I would argue then that WTO is there for business. And that is just to launch the debate of today. I'm sure that many of you would not share this view, but because I've been asked to ask this question, what is the role of the business in shaping the WTO? I would argue that actually the WTO is first and foremost a member-driven organization, as the Director General has told us this morning, and is a governmental organization, and it is not, unfortunately, done exactly for business, and a lot of politics are going into that. So despite the belief that the NGOs are thinking that we have a strong voice towards our government, I don't think we are very good in shaping our government, and we're not certainly good in shaping the WTO, otherwise we would have succeeded in pushing a decision for the conclusion of the EDA for a long time. If we look at the past, the successes, the different eight rounds at the beginning of the GATT, i.e. the Dillon round, the Kennedy round, Tokyo round, etc., the business was not actually very active in pushing for those agenda, and very, very low intervention of the business during these different round of negotiation of reducing tariff at the borders. And it is only during the Uruguay round that actually business started to be active and essentially toward the government when they heard about something might be of interest to them there, i.e. at the beginning up to the negotiation of the conclusion of the Uruguay round, it was essentially manufacturing companies which were there pushing to reduce tariff and non-tariff barriers. And only when services companies heard that actually financial services and telecom company, telecom negotiations were not completely concluded during the first big package in 1993 or 4, December 93 here. Only when the banks and telecom have been contacted, they have started to be interested in these negotiations. I would say that the mobilization of the NGOs and the trade unions have been actually very likely a trigger of the business mobilization. And it's because before and after and in Seattle, the WTO Ministerial Conference in 1999, that we've got so much mobilization from the civil society that actually business has also understood that if they want to get their voice heard, they have to be mobilized. So at that time, major business organizations started to understand and look at what was WTO, and then start to join forces. But I don't think we have been that much successful. I mean, first of all, no round has been launched in Seattle. The Doha has been launched the DDA has been launched in Doha, but I think with much more for political circumstances than for the pressure of the business. We then have got a failure at Cancun, a timid progress in Hong Kong, where we have got some decisions there, but all of them are going direction of the business. And then we've got successes, failures, on and on all the different Julys up to July 2008, where the negotiation had been stalled. And since then, well, basically nothing. Despite the business organization, despite the many different trips that have been coming in the city, all meeting different delegations, meeting different ministries in different countries in the world, nothing is moving. So we're not actually that good. Can we, as business, expect better from WTO? Yes. And it is true that in the recent years, the WTO Secretariat has actually made a lot of efforts to open up to non-state actors, including business, because believe it or not, my organization is an NGO. So it has kept this nature of intergovernmental organization, but we have got more and more access. First of all, the famous WTO public forum in which we are today is open to all participants. It is true that most of the WTO documents are becoming public. WTO Ministerial Conference, the Secretariat organized some WTO briefings to the NGOs, so we have aware of what's happening there. Also, a new thing is that the different hearings in some dispute settlement proceedings have been open to public, and that is also much welcomed, certainly, by business. But I would say that that is for all non-state actors. There is no specific there for business. Is that sufficient? I mean, can we, as business, be happy with that, and does the WTO serve the business interest? I think that's a question that we have to raise ourselves. Well, let's take a bit backwards and think about what does a company need to do international business. You know, if just think about it, you are a CEO, you're on a board of a company, and you would like to see, okay, I'm going to do an international trade, I'm going to be a multinational company, even if you're doing business with two different countries, you're a multinational company. What do you need? Well, we would look at different criteria to see whether there are good conditions to do international business. We will look at the different tariffs for to import goods. We will look at the different rules of origin to be implemented by the countries there to get the products. We will look at the business environment in the different countries we would like to do business with, i.e. the availability and the price of human capital, which is obviously an important thing. The level of education, the different potential market size, the existing competition on the different countries, what are the standard certification, etc., the benefit, what are the good governance, what is the state of regulation, what are the different FDI incentive or disincentive, like special zones, tax incentive, etc., etc. Well, actually, WTO cannot deal fully very much with all of this, and only few aspects of the WTO can be dealt with. The business can expect from WTO to provide a multilateral system that fixes the global rules on the world market. We would like to get lower tariff, lower non-tariff barriers, lower unfair subsidies. We would like to allow market entry to products and services to non-domestic actors, i.e. a company and a trade nationality should not count. A worldwide international treaty that provides legal security to trade and investment is what we want. And that is what the WTO can deliver by providing the conclusion of a round of negotiation. This will bring new rules, new commitment by the countries. And what we really also are very looking at WTO is about the dispute settlement, which is crucial for this organization's success. If one country does not respect its obligation, the WTO can apply WTO sanctions. And that is actually a very important aspect of this organization. And I think that in this crisis that we have gone through, the fact that it is true that we haven't seen that much protectionism is because we have these dispute settlements in place and countries will be hit if they try to do something. And that is something that we like from the WTO. So for that aspect, yes, the WTO has delivered something for business. But that is my last slide, Chairman. If we look at what we want and what is in the reality, the companies want first around of the WTO, then, if nothing else, regional agreement, if not, bilateral agreement, and yes, we will take autonomous liberalization by countries to do reforms in their own country and to open up if that is possible, because that is the only way we can do. But in the reality, we first have autonomous liberalization, which is not giving us any legal security. We then have our government going into BITs and FTAs, and then the WTO is not happening. The DDA started 9 years ago. The last one has been concluded 16 years ago. So my conclusion is, I'm afraid that, at least on that part of it, business interests are not yet properly served by WTO. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Your last slide was the most interesting and the most provocative, and I'm sure there's going to be some comments on that as well as a discussion. May I request Ricardo. Ricardo Melendez Ortiz is the co-founder and Chief Executive of ICTSD since 1996. Previously, he was the co-founder and general director of the Fundación Futuro Latinoamérica in Quito, Ecuador. He has been a negotiator with the government of Colombia before leaving the government and getting into the NGO sector. Among several others, I think everybody is familiar with ICTSD, so let me not dwell much on that, except the fact that I was also a co-founder of ICTSD in 1996. Ricardo serves in several policy, international policy initiatives like the Board of the Intellectual Property Watch, the Steering Committee of DFID's Global Trade and Finance Architecture Initiative, and of the UN Sustainable Development Knowledge Partnership. Also a member of the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda Council on Trade, and on the forum's working group on trade and climate change. Over to you, Ricardo.
Well, thank you, Pradeep. I'm delighted to be here. I'm delighted to be back in a panel with Cuts. And, well, let me tail on that introduction from Pradeep to also pay tribute to Pradeep for the work that he has done from the civil society perspective on issues related to trade, to international trade, to consumer protection, to the participation of stakeholders in all these discussions. Also because of his great vision in being the founder of ICTSD, of course. So thank you, Pradeep. On to the question that you have asked us to look into. The issue is that you particularly asked me to refer to is non-state actors and particularly the civil society organizations. So I don't intend to give you an academic perspective on these issues. I'm not going to talk about governance, representativeness, agency, those sort of things that you usually hear when you're trying to define or to justify from a theoretical perspective participation in decision-making, in policy-making, but rather try to speak from the practical experience of the 14 years that we have lived through in ICTSD, trying to influence, as I think is the question that you're asking, in the agenda, the WTO system. Now, from there, a quick note on the denomination of non-state actors. Let me just say that I was happy to find that in the agenda. I'm also happy to see that Patrick Law will be launching a book, I think, tomorrow on the question of non-state actors, governments, and the WTO. I think that's, by and large, a good category that help us think about the various, if you like, components of the stakeholders in international trade policy or in any type of governance at the global level on economic issues. It's better than the civil society organizations in that it goes beyond what should be probably non-private interest, although I believe that we are all civil in society, probably with the exception of the military, and so that's also a category that is too blurry. It's also much better than NGOs, which is restricted to organizations, and it's not, and leaves outside a great deal of actors like academics, experts, and other types of individual actors that are also of great relevance in trade policy making processes. So that said, I'll come back a little bit later into this. Now, for operational purposes, too, we just saw it in the presentation by Pascal. It does make sense to try to understand what are the different roles, specific roles, if you like, of specific categories of actors as they relate to trade policy making processes. And in the case of trade, well, trade policy has been traditionally, because of the origins of the trade system, the embedded liberalism that really informed the beginnings of the GATT and so on, a mercantilist approach has usually been favored by governments and trade negotiators. Not that that is good for business, but that has at the same time favored the participation of business. I know that Pascal just said that was not actually the case during the early times of the GATT. Indeed, something that was quite interesting in the early GATT years is that consumers were probably the primary stakeholder and a supporting stakeholder, if you like, a supporting constituency to the agenda of trade liberalization. But again, that said, when the WTO moves from being an organization and a system that is focused in the GATT, particularly in the GATT years, on liberalization of trade and particularly on border measures, into a rules-making-centric system, then it gets into a completely different game, and that's when, I guess, all these questions of how to involve other actors and the questions from the actors on how to get themselves involved come about. So that's what is, in a way, at the origin of ICTSD. Now, let me just use, as I said before, the experience that we had with ICTSD in the past few years to try to influence the system. So the first question, again, why should actors, non-state actors, participate in a system where governments interact to manage their economic relationships? And two, how did they do it, and then are they effective in doing so? So the why, well, it has to do with sort of the very basic functions of good governance. It's about bringing voice of those that are disenfranchised or on those issues that are disenfranchised in the sense that they don't find a natural advocate in the political systems. It's about balancing private interest against public interest. It's about connecting the various stakeholders to policymaking processes and objectives. It's about raising awareness. It's about bringing knowledge, analysis, information, best practice to the trade policymaking processes. And it's above all about awareness, about accountability, and about access to justice. So when I say accountability, I mean accountability in the sense of ensuring that trade policy delivers against the policy objectives for which it has been crafted. So if we're looking at international agreements, what we have always argued from ICTSD is that at the end of the day, process may be as important as it is in legitimating a system of decision-making, but we like to look at the results, and those results should be tested against the policy objectives, again, that were set by countries when they agree to those provisions or those concessions or whatever it is at light. Accountability is also ensuring that there is accountability in the performance and in the operations of the institutions that have to do with trade policy. Now, trade policy is a game that is played is still more or less on the traditional two-level structure, two-level scheme of games, where you have at the domestic level a process of transactions between interest, stakeholders, and so on, and the governments that represent them and that actually make trade policy. Those governments then articulate that trade policy and bring it to the international level. Then you have that other game that happens at the international level, where you have primarily, again, a transaction of interest among the different countries, in the case of the WTO. What is new to that two-level game, once again, the WTO gets into rules and gets into domestic policies, is that you then get into a more complex scheme of that it's, you could say it's multi-level with with a multiplicity of actors playing roles also in a transnational manner. So they're crossing borders. They are connected across borders. Some of them work on international or global issues, and the game then becomes a much more, again, complex undertaking, as well as the stakes are much more complex. Now, again, from the ICTSD perspective, what we aim to do when we were set up back in 95, 96, was to influence the trade system such that trade policy, not just in the WTO, but in the complex landscape of trade agreements outside that make the international trade regime, and at the domestic level, will support objectives of sustainable development. Now, I won't get into sustainable development. It's too short a session to do that. But suffice it to say that, the first obstacle, if you like, that we encountered when we tried to set up a strategy was the realization that we were dealing with terribly deep asymmetries of information and capabilities between the kind of stakeholders that would be necessary to bring together to take trade policy to that type of supportive role. Now, how to address those asymmetries has been what we have been working on in the past 14 years. And we decided to sort of organize our constituencies in a different way. We believe that when you're trying to, again, influence the system, it's not only the non-state actors that are important, but it's really the non-trade actors. So we brought into the equation all those in government at the domestic, about the national level, the subnational level, but also the international level, that work and advocate other agendas in the public sphere. Once we organize stakeholders in this manner, then and then into more specific categories, including the inclusion of business at different levels in different countries and so on, then we set up a strategy that favored, first of all, information, context setting, basically enabling the stakeholders' understanding and articulation of their own concerns and interests, then a dialogues platform that will provide opportunities, spaces to those stakeholders to interact with the trade policymakers, and then a program of research and analysis that will help them get deeper into the understanding and the knowledge of the issues so that they can effectively, they could all effectively address the issues of concern. So what's the result of that? I think that, I'm not in the position to judge the work that we have done, but I would think that thousands, for what we know, thousands of stakeholders around the world have been enabled in a very functional manner, in a very specific manner, to participate at the different levels, again, of policymaking in this complexity of trade. Let me just probably try to close here. There was much more that I wanted to share with you, but I'll do it in the questions and answers session. If I had to respond to the question, do not state actors have a role? Yes, they do have a role, certainly. And do they influence the systems? Yes, they do. Let me just stop there, and then I'm happy to engage with all of you in questions and answers. Thank you.
Thank you, Ricardo. Thank you very much. I'm going to invite Michael Hindley, the next panelist. He has been a member of the European Parliament 1984-1999, and in that capacity he has also been the Vice President of the External Economic Affairs Committee, with parliamentary responsibilities for scrutiny of the entire range of European Union's external bilateral and multilateral relations, among other things. So he brings in this very rich experience which he has had. So we've had a business representative and non-state actor or civil society representative, now a parliamentarian. Over to you, Michael. Thank you. It's not working?
Just no facility there, sir.
This one?
Sorry.
Cheers, Mike.
Thank you very much indeed for the invitation. I shall attempt a very difficult discipline as a former member of Parliament, and that I shall try to be brief and to the point. Let me pick up on some of the things that have been said already. This is not, I was under polite duress to provide a PowerPoint presentation. This is all you're going to get. These are Ed memoirs rather than me talking you through that, although I will in fact refer to the points I've made there. It's interesting. Let me pick up the chairman's remark first, because I do recall 1995, 1996, when the WTO was being set up, and I was very much involved in the question of accountability, who they reported to, and what the next steps were. And one comment stuck in my mind about that process at Marrakesh, when someone asked what the structures were going to be to deliver this process. And one of the people who had been very intimately concerned as an advisor to John Major, who at that stage was the British Prime Minister, when asked some of these detailed questions, she said very honestly, well, you know, we didn't go into the detail because all the politicians' eyes were on the political fix and the photo opportunity at the end of the conference to show that progress was being made. And I think that that's an honest answer, an accurate one, a realistic one. I would, at the risk of being too general, I'll make the following generalization. I think much that has gone wrong since 1996, the stuttering performance of the Doha round, has been that consistently the political elites have signed up for things which they're having great difficulty selling. And taking people along with. There was the assumption that because a conference has decided something, the putting into practice of that is somehow automatic. That tendency, I'm afraid, has increased. As a fully paid-up Democrat, I'm constantly alarmed at the empowerment without any legitimate base for G7s, G8s, G20s, making decisions which give direction, one might argue a much-needed direction, to economic planning, yet they lack any system of accountability. What to do about Africa? Well, let's not talk about democracy in Africa, balance of trade, empowerment of people as economic actors in Africa. Let's set up, apart from the rock concert, let's have a G8 summit on Africa, and things will flow from that. And I think we are at a stage where that kind of political elite making grand statements is becoming more and more cut off from any kind of democratic accountability, and this is which I wish to focus on now. The first one is First Aid Memoirs, an excellent book by an American journalist called William Grider. His title, Who Will Tell the People, is in effect, if I can paraphrase him, who is going to explain to the ordinary voters what has been decided at G8 and at the WTO forums. And of course his answer to that is that the politicians, naively or through ambition, have volunteered to be the interface between the decision already made, which they may or may not have agreed with but are expected to deliver, and the people who elect them. And in that process, lost touch. So my constant concern has always been how to get politicians to take politics seriously. That moves me to the second issue about accountability. It's interesting, previous speakers spoke of, used the term disenfranchisement. It's commonly used now to indicate people's lack of identification with what's happening globally. It's interesting also that the political term has been used because the struggle for democracy in all countries has been driven by the idea if people got the vote, they would have more power over their lives. And we forget that. I say use Oxfam not as any offense to Oxfam, as I use it as an example of an NGO that everybody knows of. But Oxfam's, as it were, political legitimacy is at best dubious. It is a group of well-meaning people doing very nice things, much of which I support. But Oxfam is not going to vote on the implementation of the implications of public procurement. This is going to be done by elected politicians. And that's why I said, you know, I voted being a Labour man. I didn't vote a Conservative or a Liberal Democrat in the last British elections. But I do accept that the British Conservative Lib Dem coalition has a legitimacy beyond that which many other would-be actors in the policy-making process can ever claim or would ever wish to claim. And I'm always struck by the way that the political debate on trade policy is existing in parallel universes. The academics who often took the NGOs, and the NGOs often are academics or become academics or wish to become academics. But the crossover into influence on the political process is minimal. And sometimes I think particularly the civic society is quite happy with that, not wishing to get its hands dirty with that dreadful political world of deals and passing bills and so on. The major problem I see and have seen is that trade policy remains, for strategic reasons, always part of executive power. And I think this is frankly unsupportable in the 21st century. And we do need to find ways. How is a matter for all national governments and the national population in keeping with their own traditions, but how to reconnect with the executive, which has been likened in trade negotiations to a dog on a very, very long leash. And I'm interested in making that leash shorter by making the decision-making process more accountable, rather than the emphasis being on how to implement decisions that have already been made. I was interested as well in the reference to the multilateral agreement on investment, which in fact you were referring to the first speaker. This was once touted as the next logical step after the setting up of the WTO. And for all the criticism and all things in favor, slipped from the kind of collective memory has been the fact that the MAI, as it was called, didn't get through, although it was wished for by the business community, banking community and so on, simply because the French and the European Parliament voted it down. Not because they were being obstructionists, not because they wanted to hoist the French flag above world concerns, but because they remembered their legitimate role and proper role of how to get what is suggested past not only a domestic audience in a critical sense, but a domestic voter. And that must remain, I think, the touchstone of how we evolve ourselves and influence trade policy. And that's why, again, we're always put the slogan, don't we, that one should act locally, think globally. And that's why I changed it slightly and wrote up there that we should always think globally, but remember that we vote think globally, but we must all vote locally. We do vote locally. And that's where the pressure point must come when we start to engage in changing things and arranging things. The national has been much underestimated. The general feeling, and I know this very strongly from being in the European Parliament, is that national is automatically negative, that national automatically equates to protectionism. And this isn't true. It's a suitable and useful argument. But you cannot lose sight of that simple equation that whatever you think is in the world's interest or Europe's interest or the nation's interest must be explained and must be convincing in a manner to the people who will actually suffer the consequences of your decisions. And that's why I put at the end a plea, really, for the reemergence of the social dimension in trade. It's interesting to see, for example, that the obvious that most people will interact with globalism at a local level in their jobs and their communities has slipped entirely off the agenda since the mid-1990s. The European Union came to those final negotiations wanting a social agenda. No one mentioned at the time trade and the environment. But two decades on, we have trade and environment as part, an integral part of the WTO agenda and discussion, and we don't have the obvious connection between trade and the social. And the social agenda is the only way I see of properly reconnecting the political elites, parliamentary accountability, and people who are met by those decisions. At that time, Leon Britton, who was a successful trade minister and then EU commissioner, talked about the WTO settlement being global 1992. 1992 was shorthand for the completion of the European Union's internal market. And even the right-wing forces at that stage acknowledged the general European consensus that there had to be, what it should be is another matter, but there had to be a social agenda. And the question was always put to Leon Britton that, you know, as he accepted as a European politician the social agenda, then where was the social agenda for world trade? It's not the only answer, it's not a shortcut, but if I go back to my starting point, I think the only way of reconnecting a somewhat long-leashed dog of political elites in the trade policy formation with the people who are affected by those decisions is resurrecting the notion that there must be a social agenda to what we're discussing, and that that social agenda must be dealt with. 99.9% of people in the world who are all affected by world trade live in nation states. The other 1%, I think, are living in Geneva and working for the WTO. And it is in that context that we have to re-engage trade policy making with what happens on the ground by to the people in whose name we frequently and sometimes arrogantly and inaccurately claim we are acting. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Michael. Now invite Ujjal Singh Bhatia. Ujjal used to be the ambassador, Indian ambassador to the WTO as recently as last month. He just retired. He belongs to the Indian Administrative Service, which is a civil service of India, which sort of general government management role they have, and they have a very wide experience in this. But the beauty about Ujjal is that he has been dealing with trade policy for several years that I have known him, and it is one of his special interests other than golf. Over to you, Ujjal.
Thanks. It's very rare to hear people equating beauty with me, but that's another story. The organizers have asked me to say a few words about the structuring of the consultative process with non-state actors in India. I will do that, but beyond that, I would also like to make a few comments on the role that non-state actors can or should play in the WTO in terms of agenda setting and decision making. I would also like to make some brief comments on some of the points which my colleagues in the panel have made already. On the issue of consultations within national borders, it is important that there is a consultative process that enables the government to formulate positions that reflect the interests and aspirations of all stakeholders. While the specifics of such a process will differ from country to country, the basic elements are fairly obvious. Firstly, a structured consultative process involving concerned interests in business and civil society. Secondly, a process to arbitrate differences among such stakeholders. Thirdly, a process to take on board the views of legislators. Fourthly, an interministerial process to resolve differences between various government departments. And fifthly, a cabinet process to take final decisions based on a consideration of all views emerging from these consultations. In addition to these, in a federal setup like in India, it is also necessary to install a process of formal consultations with state governments. Apart from being helpful in building consensus around positions, such consultations are necessary in view of constitutional provisions, as a number of issues in the WTO agenda involve state jurisdiction or concurrent jurisdiction of the states and the central government. So in India, the consultative process generally proceeds along these lines. I would not like to get into specific details, but let me just say that the process runs fairly smoothly, and there have been very few complaints from stakeholders of being ignored or being bypassed. Where there are complaints, as there have been by some civil society organizations in the ongoing India-EU FTA negotiations, for instance, they are quickly taken on board to the extent possible. The consultations on agricultural issues are especially challenging, both because of the sensitivity of the sector on which two-thirds of Indians depend for sustenance, as well as for the fact that there are few established bodies which represent the diverse interests of agriculturists across the board. Let me move on to the second issue, the role of non-state actors beyond national borders. And here we move to more difficult ground. there are a number of issues which arise in a consideration of this role, and at least as far as I'm concerned, there are no clear answers. Now I'd like to specifically refer to the issue of fishery subsidies, which is part of the Doha negotiating agenda. I believe it provides a good case study for asking these questions. Fishery subsidies in a number of developed countries have contributed to overfishing and trade distortions. Thus, it can be argued that both environmental and trade issues are involved in this. Some influential civil society organizations, with the support of prominent media and Hollywood personalities, have been instrumental in pushing up the profile of this issue and have been lobbying various delegations for strong outcomes. They have also lobbied the G20 leaders to include this issue in their deliberations. These efforts are understandable and quite in line with the lobbying that a number of business groups like Pascal's Group, the CSI, Business Europe, NFTC, NEM, US Farm Bureau, etc. take up on a regular basis. But nevertheless, the fisheries issue raises some questions regarding the role that non-state actors play in the WTO processes. Firstly, in terms of agenda setting at a broader level, if the concern is about conservation and environmental issues, why take up fisheries alone? What about, say, forestry, which is as much a problem, or hydrocarbon subsidies, which is an even larger problem? A large number of countries, developed and developing, are guilty of subsidizing hydrocarbons and contributing to global warming. This has both trade and environmental implications. Is the WTO unable to discuss this issue because the hydrocarbon industry is too strong? Why are there no influential civil society organizations lobbying for this? Why should the FAO not be deemed to be the competent body to handle the issue of overfishing? Thus, it can be argued that a selective agenda setting based on the lobbying efforts of influential CSOs can open the WTO to a variety of questions. The second issue is more important for developing countries, and that is in the public debate on overfishing and subsidies, we tend to understate a crucial dimension, which is that millions of poor people in developing countries depend on coastal fisheries for their survival. Their governments provide few subsidies, and overfishing is not always a problem in several jurisdictions. This perspective has not received the kind of attention in the public debate that it deserves, mainly because there are few CSOs in developing countries with the resources to present their point of view at a global level. The imbalance between the reach of CSOs, and I think Ricardo referred to this as an asymmetry, the reach of CSOs in developing and developed countries raises an important issue regarding the credibility of the non-state actors' consultative processes on WTO issues. This was amply reflected in the discussions in the past on opening up of the panel and appellate body hearings, and more importantly, in the debate a few years back on the acceptance of amicus curiae briefs by panels and by the appellate body. Let me emphasize that I'm not saying that fishery subsidies should not be in the negotiating agenda, nor am I in any way arguing that CSOs should not play a role in the agenda setting and deliberative functions of the WTO. I've been an admirer of the role that CSOs have played in recent years in influencing the debate on access to medicines, for instance. Nevertheless, from a developing country perspective, the relative weakness of developing country CSOs as compared to their developing country counterparts is an important issue. Ricardo referred to this issue, and I would also like to say that organizations like the ICTSD and indeed CARTS have been playing a very vital role in trying to address this asymmetry. But nevertheless, the problem cannot be wished away. On this, I'd just like to make a couple of comments more. One is the comment which Michael raised about putting this entire process of negotiations on a shorter leash as far as parliamentarians are concerned. I think that's a valid concern. I think it's valid because parliamentarians have a certain legitimacy, perhaps a higher legitimacy than other NSAs. And it is important that we try to structure an interactive process at the global level between parliamentarians and the WTO. The IPU has been playing this role, but I think this interaction needs to be strengthened. On the last issue, Pascal Carnes made a point that business has not been successful in influencing either the agenda of the WTO or the decision-making processes. One of the reasons why that has happened in the last 10 years is that there is a certain countervailing interest from other non-state actors, and they have been trying to put their points across with equal strength as businesses. I certainly would not accept that the WTO exists for businesses alone, for the reasons which Michael mentioned, that whatever decisions we do take in the WTO affect the lives of hundreds of millions of people around the world. And therefore, it is legitimate for other actors to be involved in these processes, and perhaps it makes decision-making more difficult, and that is, to a large extent, it explains the blockage that we have in the Doha round. But I think in the long run, this is all for the good. Thank you.
Thank you, Bujal, and congratulations for keeping well within time without the need to flag it. Dr. Abul Barakat, he's the professor and chair of the economics department of the University of Dhaka, Bangladesh, a very renowned university in our part of the world. He joined the economics department of the University of Dhaka in 1982. Due to his academic excellence coupled with high-quality research and publications in the diverse field of economics, he became a full professor at a very young age of 35 years. In recognition of his groundbreaking research work in economic sciences, Dr. Barakat has received many awards. The most recent is the Justice Ibrahim Memorial Gold Medal, awarded by the University of Dhaka in 2007. He has specialized in his PhD on the political economy of development. With that, he brings in another dimension to this panel, that of an academic. And over to you.
First of all, let me thank Kars International for inviting me to present in this session. My title is Role of Non-State Actors in the WTO, Improving Relationship Modalities. I would like to limit my presentation within the time allocated by raising some pertinent issues as well as by forwarding some suggestions for consideration. The first issue I want to raise is that who are the non-state actors? I'm not going to define. What is the extent of their influence on power dynamics? What they know about WTO and how they contribute to the WTO process? While I do not intend to define non-state actors, I think that non-state actors in the relevant literature is relatively poorly defined and loosely used depending on the context and settings. Non-state actors include civil society or civil society organizations, CSOs, including NGOs, non-government organizations, business organizations, excluding for-profit enterprises, parliamentarians, academia, media, and so on. Non-state actors can be international, national, sorry, regional, national, and subnational. Among the national-level non-state actors, prominent ones, for example, in Bangladesh, include chambers of business community, parliamentarians, especially members of various standing committees in the parliament, elected professionals' bodies, for example, Bangladesh Economic Association or Medical Association, lawyer associations, academia, various non-government organizations, and in case of Bangladesh, non-government organizations and CBOs, community-based organizations, officially numbering over 200,000, trade unions and associations of various occupational groups, formal and informal sectors, cooperative associations, various rights-based organizations, various cultural organizations, various citizens' committees, and so on and so forth. Theoretically, these non-state actors can exert power broadly on three areas. First area can be termed as decisional power in terms of policy making and political influence. The second area is discursive power in terms of framing and reframing of discourses. The third area is regulatory power in terms of rule making and setting standards. Viewing from these three dimensions of power for non-state actors, for example in Bangladesh, let me point three observations. Number one, a very few non-state actors are active, and most are not active or inactive in serving public interest and act as efficient interlocutor and partner of government. For example, business chambers are active in setting trade policies, tariffs, fiscal policies sometimes, even monetary policies. Academia and think tanks in raising issue of non-tariff protectionist measures by developed economies. Bangladesh Economic Association, for example, in guiding development policy and WTO issues. Bangladesh Pharmaceutical Association, for example, in raising issue of patent of life-saving drugs. And cultural organizations in preserving and patenting traditional and indigenous knowledge. Secondly, proactiveness of various non-state actors in their relationship with and participation in government's policy making varies depending on the individual association's image, acceptability, strength, and interest. And third, most actors are not adequately represented in the relevant processes or are represented as token within inverted comma. Therefore, the cumulative impact of these non-state actors in Bangladesh is more pronounced on discursive power than on other two areas of power, which is decisional power and regulatory power. Most non-state actors groups work individually in isolation without coordination with others. It is important to note that most of the national actors are not only ill-equipped in terms of knowledge about globalization and WTO, but also, I want to underline, most are globophobes and WTO phobes. This phobia most likely is attributable to three key reasons. Namely, number one, non-state actors' lack of adequate knowledge about WTO and globalization. Secondly, much aggressive campaign and propaganda of the prophobes. And third, rising inequality, creating fertile ground for prophobes. Therefore, I think a mechanism has to be devised to facilitate objective knowledge building of these actors about various relevant issues of their interest on WTO and globalization. I also think that the relevant department or cell or section or division of WTO dealing with knowledge sharing, information dissemination and learning may be entrusted with the responsibility to perform this high utility job for the non-state actors. The second issue I intend to raise is about channels and modalities. of non-state actors, WTO relationship. In the WTO-NSA relationship, the two key broad areas of interactions are related to policy setting and operational implementation. Non-state actors are not fully integrated in the WTO structure and governance and are not equal decision makers, implying absence of institutionalized modality under policy setting role. Whether or not non-state actors have formal status in the WTO through officially defined criteria and procedure and relationship with WTO is equal is less clear, implying lack of accreditation, consultative status, modality in the relationship between WTO and non-state actors. However, non-state actors' status in WTO is distinctly pronounced in terms of policy dialogue modality through issue-specific engagement, which is submodality, precession, which means few hand-picked worthy individuals of specific groups are placed on committees. This policy dialogue modality has the strength of listening the voice and weakness of no promise of incorporation of voice into decision making. Under broad area operational and implementation, the cooperation agreement modality in which non-state actors are seen as an integral part or work through contractual agreement is less practiced. However, partnership modality consisting operational activities such as advocacy, coordination, information and learning is more pronounced in relationship between NSAs and WTO. Therefore, it is evident in terms of WTO-NSA relationship, the NSAs are engaged in less influencing, less productive channels. This permits me to forward three suggestions. Number one, adequate measures are needed to involve and engage the NSAs in WTO towards maximizing non-state actors' contribution in the process. Number two, more emphasis should be given towards equipping the relevant non-state actors so that they can contribute as an integral part of the WTO. And number three, non-state actors should be knowledge-wise more equipped, and in doing that, WTO needs to think proactively. And finally, the power of non-state actors is a contested issue ranging between debates between neorealists and transnationalists. Rich plurality of academic views should be welcomed, and at the same time, means and ways have to be devised to maximize non-state actors' contribution to WTO by creating conducive environment for NSAs through which they can enjoy more decisional, discursive, and regulatory powers. Finally, it is pertinent to conclude that WTO's individualized approach to non-state actors has reached its limit. Therefore, it might be appropriate to think about some sort of standardized and coherent self-regulating organizational umbrella modality that would enhance effectiveness and accountability. Non-state actors are capable of reshaping patterns and outcomes of global governance because under the rapidly changing world, with the broadening of the development agenda and inclusion of new actors, governing the governors has become a real emerging issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That has been a very rich array of viewpoints. Let me just pick up a point each from these speakers in order to help the audience, including to invite views of the audience particularly. One of the interesting, and this is not to say that the several points made by each of the speakers are not interesting, I leave it to you, but my take as the moderator or as the chair of this session. Pascal's last slide, he spoke about the fact is that a DDA is important, and there are problems. While the governments are pursuing regional trade agreements, there are problems of lack of legal security or legal protection. And at the same time, if there are too many bilateral agreements, then there is the issue about the lack of convergence. This is a little away from the topic, but I thought it was a very interesting point, and I leave it to you to respond to that. In terms of Ricardo, I think an important point which he made was for us to understand the fact is that trade impacts a lot of other people, including actors. So, and then he came up with this very interesting definition of non-trade actors, in the sense that people who are not necessarily, whether they are concerns of human rights or labor standards or environment and so on, and so therefore the issue of reaching out to them. Michael spoke about the fact about legitimacy, and this is something which has been questioned quite often, though he himself contradicted it as well in his own. The fact is that you said that trade policy making is mainly within the powers of the executive and rather than the elected legislatures. The fact is, as I noted in my own opening statement, that a large number of agreements which are done here leave very little scope for national governments to design policy. I mean, it's more or less like a compliance issue which needs to be done. You spoke about the MAI as well. I don't know whether the French voted it down, but they were worried about the audiovisual products, and that was the sort of main thing. Ujjal Bhatia's taking up the fisheries subsidies as a case study, very interesting and a very very logical deduction as to how selective agenda setting can be done by non-state actors on a particular aspect, and therefore there is a big risk about the same. Spoke about the process of national consultations, etc. Since I've been a part of the national consultation process in India, and I dare say that it is a fairly advanced version, except that it has not been institutionalized, and that is where the problem is. So it depends on the whims of the ministers or the bureaucrats who are in charge. It varies in the consultation. But at the same time, the consultation which has taken place in India over a period of time involving non-state actors has been very high. Finally, Professor Abdul Barak, Barakat's suggestion, the issue about mechanism for objective knowledge building, and that reminds me of something which the governments have committed themselves at Doha in terms of, if somebody remembers paragraph 10 of the Doha Declaration, it talks about confidence building measures that every government has to step forward and to build higher. And one of the ways they can do it in the best way is how they can do it through the kind of NGOs who are already engaged, other than the other instruments, which could be through the elected representatives and so on and so forth. Let me open the floor for comments, questions, interventions. Yes, please. And please do identify yourself. And if you are addressing a particular speaker, please name the person also.
Thank you very much. My name is Jörg Leichtfried. I'm a member of the European Parliament, and I would address all gentlemen if they feel free to answer. And it's just a short question. I would ask the gentlemen maybe what they think about especially the democratic legitimacy of these non-state organizations, because, I mean, some of them are very influential, others are not, and nobody really knows who they are presenting in certain cases, and I would like to ask about that, and also question of who is funding them. Are there any other interests behind, and what do you think about these questions?
Very legitimate questions. We'll take a few questions and then turn to the panel.
Perhaps a follow-up question. Guus Houtan from the EU delegation here in Geneva. It's made easier for me by the Honourable Member of the European Parliament, but of course within Europe, you know probably better than I do, trade policy, you can hardly consider it to be part of the executive power. I now can hold a hardcover version of the Lisbon Treaty, but I think the democratic deficit leash, or at least the leash on which the trade negotiators are, was considerably shortened by indeed the Lisbon Treaty, which entered into force on the 1st of September, so 1st of December last year. So at least in a large part of the world, this indeed controlled by a category of non-state actors, of what negotiators actually are doing in these rooms has been considerably improved.
Okay. My name is Wanderlei. I'm lawyer in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. My English, but I try to speak for you. Only question to Mr. Zhu Zhao, the ambassador. How think about the Brazilian and the world contest and the internal agents Brazilians conjugate with the other countries, the BRIC, toward the multilateral system? Okay?
Hi. Hello?
Is this working?
Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah, I can't hear it. Sorry. My name is Silke Trummer. I'm from the University of Helsinki. I have a question for the first speaker. You were showing on your slide that what the business community wants is a Doha deal, but you said you've not been very successful at shaping multilateral negotiations. Now, then you also said that, you know, you would also take regional or bilateral deals if this was the case. So I was just wondering if you've been successful in shaping regional and bilateral negotiations. Thanks.
Yeah, my name is Peter Hurst, and I suppose I'm an agricultural labour, rural agricultural labour specialist who's previously worked for the International Labour Organization as well as the International Trade Union. I just want to ask a comment and a question about the lack of a social agenda. Because we're talking about shaping the WTO. Well, one of the ways the WTO is very badly out of shape is the fact it lacks a social agenda. And you're not going to get workers, whether they're in a factory or a self-employed smallholder farmer, actually taking the WTO seriously until there's some recognition that you need to start tackling social issues, paramount among which is things like labour rights, good working conditions, whether you're a self-employed person or whether you're a wage worker. So my question really to all of the panel is to say, why do we lack this social agenda, and more importantly, how can we start working towards it to shape the WTO in the right direction?
I'll turn to the panel now, and then we'll have another round of questions. Pascal, over to you.
Thank you, Bradley. Thank you for the questions. Maybe first on democratic legitimacy of the NGOs. I fully agree with your comments, and I think the register of the European Parliament and the register of the Commission there, I think a good way to go. I hope the Council will join us, will join you in this light. We need to know who is talking to. I have an open explanation who I am representing. They are public. I have the budget public. Everything is there. Everybody knows who I am. When we talk to some NGOs, it is true to question who are they representing? Who are they funding them? Is it 1,000 person? Is it 10 person? Is it 5 million person? And I think that's a legitimate question. So I would certainly favor any progress into that. On your question, Pradip, and I think it is also related to the person from Helsinki, the DDA will bring us a big legal security in many aspects. Autonomous liberalization doesn't give us any legal security. What about FTAs? Yes, FTAs and regional trade agreement, because they are international treaty, do give legal security, but there is a lack of convergence. And for the services part, most of the time when a country decides to open up, he will change his legislation not for companies of one country, but for all sectors, because it has to change its national legislation in banking or in telecom or whatever. For manufacturing, it's much more difficult, because when you go into the rules of origin, there you have different rules, and it is really damaging for the lack of convergence and the difficulty to do business. So, yes, we're going to take it, and I must say that now I spend more than 90% of my time in the FTAs, looking at the different legislation, negotiation the Commission is looking at. And the reason is because in this house in Geneva, nothing is happening. So we are doing business, and we have to look at where we had the last something to get. So yes, we are looking at the FTAs. I think, yes, we've got some success. Yes, we've got some success also in driving new agenda for the new negotiations that the Commission is doing. But I must say also that we are just trying to catch up. Many other countries in Asia, in Latin America, in the United States have already signed FTAs in the past, and the EU has not signed many FTAs for the last 15 years. And now, also to coming to your question about the Lisbon Treaty taking out legitimacy to some a part of the elected person, I think that what happened this week about a government blocking the EU-Korea signature means that there is still, they are still in power, and they are there. So I think we have to balance all of those things into this question. I will stop here.
Thank you, Pradeep. Well, I didn't hear any question directed to me, but I guess it's either I didn't make much sense, or maybe I did, and then people will agree with what I said. But two quick comments. One is on the question of representativeness and legitimacy of NGOs. I don't think that's we can make much about it. I think that I agree with Pascal. We all have a right to know who's on the other side of the table, and it would be much better if everybody discloses all those interests, supports, etc. But that's not the issue when it comes to participation from NGOs and from stakeholders. It's also not a question of numbers. Do I represent the services sector in the world? Which, what does it mean? Is it the companies that are services providers? Or is it much bigger than this? If I take it from the definitions of services in the, well, or the lack of definition, but what is understood by services in the GATS agreement, then it's a really broad constituency that we have there. So I don't think that that's a question, that's really the question of that validates or not the participation of actors in trade policy making. Stakeholders are stakeholders, whether they are small fishermen in a village that are affected by the negotiations on subsidies and fisheries, as Ujjal said, or whether they are big conglomerates, either in the private interest or not. So again, I think that that's much to do about something that is not that that relevant. Now, when it comes to the political process and some of the comments that Michael made, I also think that we need to understand that we live in the real world, and in an ideal one, I totally agree that it should be through the political process, through the political system, that, again, constituencies and stakeholders should express themselves about, for instance, trade policy. But trade policy is incredibly complex, and it's full of details. And those are very difficult to get into something like an effective, if you like, political system. We have to try to act on them in ways that make up for the imperfections that we have in this real world. And again, that's why the role of state, of non-state actors, or rather the non-trade actors, is very important. Now, one more note on that. I talked before about accountability, and when I talk about accountability of the system, and particularly of performance, so trying to test the rules, agreements, against their policy purpose, I mean being very specific and detailed about them too. So it's not about whether trade liberalization works for development. Those are sort of big questions that we cannot process really in an effective manner. It's about whether specific rules and specific agreements do respond to the, again, specific policy objectives that we have set for ourselves.
Thanks. Yes. Let me comment on the questions that relate to what I was saying. I share the skepticism, shall we put it, of the legitimacy of some NGOs. I'm very pleased that the European Parliament, my own national parliament, I think most national parliaments, has some register of interests when you become an elected member, you have to say. And there have been many scandals in recent times in my own country, and those scandals have been necessary in exposing some of the illegitimate connections. And we're sometimes reliant, as in your case in India, to a good press, exposing some of the dubious connections between legislators and government procurement and defense contracts and so on. So I share the skepticism. Simple as that. For me, the measure is always is a simple one. I was on the board of an NGO in the UK for 10 years, which had an annual conference. The annual conference decided whether we do things in India or Peru, and that program was based on a genuine dialogue with the partner. In order to get something past the executive, you had to show that there was a partner in the recipient country who agreed to what you were doing. And there was an annual vote for the board. Now, I wouldn't therefore say, and that must apply to all other NGOs, but on looking at NGOs, it's a question I and other people are entitled to ask. They do good work, but who appointed them and why they're choosing this subject rather than that subject is dubious, and certainly they have a acceptance in this public debate, which sometimes doesn't bear scrutiny. The question of the from the gentleman from the European Union, maybe in a Freudian slip, maybe in a slip of tongue or whatever, it's interesting you said that the European Union represented the largest part of the world. Well, of course it does in trading terms, but the problem with the European deceit is, of course, that Europe is a very, very small part of a very, very big world. But your point about Europe having gone much further in an exemplary way of accountability is well made and well taken. I think you'd agree with me. You took me up on the question of executive power. But in trade negotiations, the Commission, in fact, acts as an executive. On the Parliament, on the Treaty of Lisbon, when I entered the Parliament in 1984, the Parliament had the right to ratify a trade agreement. This was taken away from us by European treaties and has been restored at the Treaty of Lisbon. So what has happened has not been progress at Lisbon, but has been returned to the status quo. I'm very glad that exists, and I would like other countries, other trading entities to have the same system. But the crucial point is that I don't know of any country which has any other power other than ratifying what is put on a plate in front of them. The European Parliament says yes or no to the trade agreement, the FTA, with India. It may influence what's in there. It may indicate that if this isn't there, it may say no. But it can only say yes and no. And when it comes to the point, this real world, I've always been looking for the real world for 60 years. It all seems to be somewhere where we're not sitting now. But the real world kicks in, and there's tremendous pressure on the European Parliament not to disrupt an entire trading agreement just because people in that particular country may be knocked around or the children still working in very primitive conditions. So it is, you know, a nuclear option. What I think Parliament should be arguing for is a more nuanced, differentiated option rather than yes or no. Peter Hurst's point about what happened, why wasn't the social agenda pursued, simply because it was dropped. One, ideologically, the number of times, you know, I and many other people, not necessarily on the left, Christian Democrats, for example, the European Parliament, were simply literally laughed out of court in the mid-90s of, oh my God, must we have this bleeding heart liberalism? Can't you get it through your head that if we all trade, everybody gets richer, and, you know, people getting richer means everybody, it trickles down eventually, and if a millionaire makes £1 million, he'll employ someone to clean his Rolls Royce, and that's what makes the world go around. And that really did dominate, sometimes as crudely as that. And the other, which is thankfully coming to the end, the other one is a point I discussed earlier with Mr. Singh. That's a tyranny of statistics. The absolute tyranny of statistics. That as long as you're making statistical progress, it's all right. I attended a seminar not a million miles from here, not a million years ago, on the presentation of third world developing countries and trade, and the surprising conclusion was that some of the poorest countries in the world are statistically doing very well. And the mischievous question was, well, okay, should they just sit back and watch them grow? Because if some of the poorer countries are posting good trade stats, it is going to take 1,000 years before they lift themselves out of poverty. And that's the importance of a social agenda. We must measure progress in trade, not by ideology and not by statistics.
Thank you.
Well, I'll be selective. I'll make a few comments about the CSOs issue and then move on to my friend from Brazil. On the CSO issue, I think, let me put it this way. Of the three non-state actors that we generally consider, the parliamentarians obviously have their clear legitimacy. They represent somebody. And so do the business associations. They represent their stakeholders. Now, it's normally less clear about NGOs. But the point is, there is a space there where NGOs have to play that role. It's very important that different perspectives, which are not voiced normally by business associations and others, are voiced by somebody. And therefore, the CSOs have to play a role. Now, but which CSOs, what kind of funding mechanism do they employ? What kind of membership do they have? Do they have a secret agenda? I think this goes back to what Professor Barkat was talking about. How do we create a transparent framework for the involvement of CSOs in this international dialogue? And I think that's a point worth making. The other point which my Brazilian friend made, and I'm not really sure what he was focusing on, which is very, very good for me because it allows me to say what I want to say. But I think what he was saying was the role or the contribution of countries like India, Brazil, the BRICS countries in the multilateral trading system in the last few years. Let me just say this, that, you know, a number of people raise questions about why the Doha round is stopped. And everybody has their own take on this. But as far as the systemic issue is concerned, it's this, that in 2001 we launched a round. There were some people who were very, very keen to launch the round. And there were some people who were literally dragged in kicking and screaming. That includes countries like India. In these 9 years, in these 9 years, the tables have turned. It is those countries, many of those countries who were very, very fervent in demanding a new round, who have been very, very staunchly in their trenches. And it is these, the developing countries who were not very keen to have this round to start with, who are now the demanders for closure. So the world has changed. And why has the world changed? The world has changed because the patterns of competitiveness have changed. There are suddenly new players who are far more competitive than older players. And because of this, you have a certain shift, a change of the negotiating power in the WTO. And that's the reason why there is an impasse. Now, does it mean that this impasse should continue and that we should stick to all our positions? No, obviously not. Obviously not. Because I think more than perhaps developed countries, it is the developing countries who require a strong multilateral system. And it is important, therefore, that all of us play a constructive, flexible role to provide closure to the Doha round, because it is essential that we have a universal set of rules and regulations governing global trade. Now, in the absence, and I think Pascal is right to express his frustration with the multilateral process. We've been talking about Doha round for the last 9 years, and there is no idea when we will be able to close this deal. The world is not staying still. The world has to move on. And if you want to see some of the dynamism in the global trade system, how fast it is changing. Go to Asia. Asia is integrating before your very eyes. You're talking about the lady from Finland. She was talking about regional deals or bilateral deals. You go to Asia. There's probably one deal being signed every week, and what all this adds up to is that the entire Asian continent is integrating into one integrated supply chain, a value chain, which improves the competitiveness of each of those players, and therefore the dichotomies in competitiveness are probably going to increase rather than decrease. And therefore, one multilateral response has to be that we strengthen the processes here, we complete the negotiations as quickly as we can, and move on to tackle new challenges, because the world is changing very rapidly. It will not wait for us. Thanks.
Thank you. On the question of raised by member of the European Parliament, democratic legitimacy of the NGOs. I think this is a very interesting question, at the same time very complex one. The simple equation for the NGOs, most of the NGOs, not all, is that organization that pays the bill defines the relationship. And I have said already that in Bangladesh, these NGOs and CBOs, community-based organizations, the total number is more than 200,000. So Bangladesh is known as front runner in the NGO sector and CBO sector. And for many traditional NGOs, the question of democratic legitimacy and accountability, I think, is a very pertinent one. But what about those NGOs who are working in the field of EPI, for example, Expanded Program on Immunization for the Children? And outcome of their work is minimizing infant mortality, for example. Or the NGOs working in the non-formal education sector, or water, sanitation. And you know, in Bangladesh, no one knows. This is official data, that 75% of the Bangladesh population is 150 million, is at risk of arsenosis, which is arsenic in the groundwater, drinking water. So NGOs, there is one NGO, for example, providing arsenic-free household mitigation system free of cost to the poor people. Why to the poor? Because arsenosis is a disease of poverty. Poor people are disproportionately highly affected. Rich are not affected because of nutrition and so on and so forth. So I agree with Mr. Bhatia that elected non-state actors, parliamentarians, professional bodies which are elected, I said Bangladesh Economic Association, Bangladesh Medical Association, Association of Engineers, Nurses, so on and so forth. Then business chambers, they are elected. Then association of various occupational groups, for example, fishers, okay, and also academia. I don't think there is a problem here. I think there's a problem with the NGOs, but NGOs are registered with the relevant department in the government, and that is not enough. So to respond to your question, I don't know whether it will be accepted in my own country or not. I think NGOs should be accountable to the people, and how it should be reflected. I think that it should be reflected through they are presenting in the relevant parliamentary standing committees. So let them present. We have parliamentary standing committee on health. There are 68 on education, on women. So NGO working in the health, let them present in the parliamentary standing committee. and let them also present regularly their funding sources and outcomes. But there is a problem with statistics. There are three types of lies: lie, damn lie, and statistics. So, I said this is a complex issue. But I think the accountability and legitimacy issue of the NGOs should be thought of in the whole process. Thank you.
Thank you. I think on that last note, since I head an NGO myself, and I've been, and without misusing the privilege of the chair, I must respond to the kind of accountability that we profess. And I dare say that my organization, CUTS, is probably quite unique in this way, this manner, as against a very large number of NGOs, and we hope we can inspire them, is that every grant that we receive, including the name of the donor, the activity, etc., is there on our website. There is a project at a glance which we keep on putting up at our website. And this we do in spite of the fact that it is sort of your trade secret, for want of a better word, to spill out as to... I still remember Hewlett Foundation giving us a grant to set up the Geneva Center. So Ricardo was very worried, you know, which meant that, you know, it actually meant shrinking of his budget from the Hewlett Foundation. But it didn't matter. But the fact is that Hewlett Foundation gave us so-and-so money is there on our website. There's a process of grants which I think is a very, very unique part of it. And the idea behind this is our own obsession with accountability. Secondly, we always have a very large number of donors basket, and we ensure that not a single donor exceeds more than 15% of our budget. That is in order to ensure that, you know, your independence. We have, for your information, we have refused grants also, where we found that they were tied and they wanted a particular outcome even before the project started. So this is, sorry, we are not in this, we'll report the outcome as it happens. Thirdly, there is a rating agency globally called Credibility Alliance, which we are, a process which we are undergoing, and it's a very strenuous process. Fifthly, there is an external audit and an internal audit, which is also done, and those balance sheets are again there on our website, ever since we were founded. If you look at our website, you'll find all our financial reports on the website. There is income tax scrutiny as well. There is government audit as well, because we receive funding from the government, from various ministries, both at the central government level, which is New Delhi, and at the state government level, Jaipur. And we are also open to what is called the government audit, which is the Accountant General's audit, and those audits have been happening very frequently. So it can be quite, for our finance department, it is quite a nightmare to deal with several amount of. Let me tell you that also, Jill. And quite often, even those auditors, government auditors particularly, and let me say that publicly, also demand a bribe in order to... There is no way that anybody's accounts can always be 100% clean. It's just impossible. If you know, a chartered accountant from India is sitting here, he'll be, because there's bound to be somebody has made an error somewhere. This is wrong treatment, the other. And a government audit inspector will pick that up and make your life miserable. And that has also happened. And unless you have to... pay him off to, you know, get lost. I mean, let me be very honest about it. Thirdly, we have our board, and every 3 years we have elections also. That is another form of accountability, which is again reported on our website. Lastly, and this is something which may not be familiar with many of you, there is a Right to Information Act in India, which also applies to an NGO like us because we receive government funding. And we've had inquiries which we have used the Right to Information Act from the government in order to get information. We've had inquiries targeted at us to exhibit, to show in a particular. Lastly, there are periodical evaluations being done of projects, including the organization, depending upon the kind of thing. So there, I mean, there, in terms, we realize the fact is that accountability is very important. We are not elected in that sense. We are not elected by people. But the fact is that even in a democracy like India, it is often the elections end up in what? Of a few, by the few, for a few. You know, majority do not vote. Majority of the people do not vote. And in a country like India often, or including in countries like Kenya, for example, the vote is on a tribal ground or on a caste basis ground. So this is again not a, you know, I mean, if you look at the legitimacy of those elections, Michael, how legitimate are they? Because they do not actually represent the cross-section of people. So every process has its own, drawbacks, etc. The fact is that CUTS as an NGO has been there for about 27 years, 28 8 years, and we've had a fairly successful track record, is itself a symbol of our legitimacy, I dare say. And with that, I would like to thank you all once again for this. The fact is that, I mean, there is a broad consensus here that in trade policy making, the role of non-state actors of a variety of nature is important, is there to stay, and will expand. And with that, thank you very much for all of you to come.